Mohammed Fikri is the very definition of the frequent flyer, an executive Platinum Club member.
You have to be really insane to reach 5 million miles. I have so far 4,997,000 miles, and that's only with one airline, which is American Airlines.
Mohammed is an American himself. He moved here from Egypt 33 years ago. He'll often introduce himself as Mo instead of Mohammed. Even he wasn't sure what was happening on a recent flight.
The captain went in the intercom and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please refrain from using the facilities. Please refrain from moving out of your seat. We have a national security matter."
Mo Fikri didn't know it at the time, but he was that national security matter. And Mo never made it to the 5 million mile mark either. He says he now tries not to fly so much anymore. For him, it's not a matter of security. It's a matter of dignity. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Mohammed Fikri is a businessman. Until very recently, his job took him all over the world buying and selling restaurant equipment. He lives in Los Angeles, and for this conversation, he's joining me from a studio there. Mo says that his life started to change just 1 month after 9/11.
It was October. It was middle of October. I was coming back from Chicago from a convention that we have. And when you are coming from a convention, you have to dress the part, if you like, the suit and the tie and the briefcase and
right.
your nice watch and all that stuff. And I did that. And when I arrived to the airport in O'Hare, I was upgraded to business slash first because, you know, there's not a lot of first anymore. Mm-hmm. And I sat in seat 2B. And there was a lady came and sat next to me, and she had a book, put the book down. I was on the phone talking to one of my colleagues slash employee, if you like, in a Spanish. And in a sudden, she just left her books and left the airplane. And I thought that she was one of those people that, you know, how sometimes the airlines say, like, "Hey, we're going to give you $200 if you take the next flight, and we'll give you food, and we'll give you whatever, and food stamps, and all that wonderful stuff." I thought this was one of those. Great. Wonderful. And she was replaced by a flight attendant, a male flight attendant. And I sat in the plane, and I start writing down my notes. And unfortunately, I took that little plastic safety instruction thing where you find the gates. And when we arrived to LAX, make the long story short, and of course I wanted to go to the bathroom, and I will not, when you sit in seat 2B, it means a business class, you have every right to use that bathroom in the front. I did not use the bathroom because it's just adjacent to the cockpit.
What's the big deal about going to the bathroom that's up at the front of the aircraft?
I'll tell you what's the big deal is, you are in Carolina, I'm in LA. You don't see it the way I look. I look like Mohammed. And that's after 9/11. Oh, whoa. Stay away from that cockpit, mister.
Oh, don't even walk in that direction is what you're saying.
Oh, heck no. Heck no. I mean, you just walk with your head down. And when I arrive to LAX, I hear Mohammed. And if you hear the name, "Hey, Mr. Gordon," believe me, you might look back, but there's a lot of Mr. Gordon in the U.S. Mohammed, there's not a lot of Mohammed in a 737 coming out of O'Hare. And I looked back, and it was a captain coming to me with his hand extended. "Hi, how are you?" In a second, there was two policemen, and there is three. You know how the FBI, CIA, they put their hand in their pocket, and they go like, boom, here's my badge, FBI, CIA, and I'm like, oh, whoa, great.
Now, where is this happening, Mohammed? Is this happening?
LAX.
I know, but where you pick up your bags or outside?
The minute you leave the airport, right on the jetway.
On the ramp that takes you off the aircraft.
Correct, sir.
So there's a lot of people watching you. If you're one of the first ones off and you've got police and the captain and everyone surrounding you.
Yeah, everybody was looking at me and it was like, it was so embarrassing. They said that I was copying down safety instruction of the airplane. And that's when I really went, "Jesus, I need your help. Moses, please cover my back. Mohammed, please come through to me. God, if you have any other prophet, please name him because I beg of all of them." I did not keep that plastic instruction. And they opened my briefcase. And guess what? I did not take it, thank God. And they start reading my handwriting. and they understood that I was talking about machinery and mechanical stuff. And they said that the flight attendant next to me said that I had my phone on during the whole entire flight.
Mo, I'm completely baffled here. If they think that you're some kind of bad guy, why do they wait until the end of the flight to accost you? And, I mean, if all they think is that you're scribbling out stuff on the plastic safety instructions, I mean, there is nothing there of value. I don't. Are you asking them these questions? Are they telling you what they suspect you of?
Yeah, that's what they told me. And the lady next to me, the reason why she left her spot is because I looked Middle Eastern and I was speaking that foreign language on the phone. When I go like, oye, señor, una pregunta, por favor, ¿sabes qué? Yo quiero esto, esto, esto. Does that sound like Arabic to you, or Afghanistani or Irani? And she looked very well educated, but she didn't understand that hasta luego is Spanish. It doesn't mean ma'a salama in Arabic.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Mohammed Fikri thought the incident with the airline was past him. He hadn't broken any laws, and the authorities had let him go. But once he settled back into his office routine, he noticed that someone had been calling. A lot.
One day I walk into the office, and I see this message just over and over, and the guy calls like twice every day.
And he's saying, what, I want to meet with you, or you have to answer some questions? What is he saying?
No, he just left a message to call Mr. Abe Pop-Pop-Pop. About 9 phone calls later, I was at the office, and I get this call. Michelle, my secretary, said, well, this gentleman, Abe's on the phone. I said, Michelle, I just came from a trip. Please take a message, and I'll call him back. And we're talking in the intercom in my office. She's in her office. She's paging me. And she said, oh, no, he has to talk to you now. I said, no, I'm not going to talk to him now. Just tell him I got to call him back. I was really occupied. And she get back in the intercom. She said, he told me to tell you that he's a part of the FBI. Okay. Yes, what can I do for you? He said, this is a pop, pop, pop. You're going to be in your office for a while. I'm on my way. Click. He came to the office. He saw my operation. He saw the grease. He saw the bearings. He saw the sprockets. He saw the motors. And he knew that what I did for a living is a clean thing. And he was very apologetic.
Did he apologize for the way that you were treated when you were taken off the aircraft as well?
No, no, no. When you give somebody an apology, I think it's something very big. But he said that I'm clean. He said he's been taking cases like that, and he's going to make sure that the case is closed and it will never be open again. And after that, everything went back to normal.
Let me ask you something if I can, Mo.
Sure.
I'm interested in knowing if there was a little part of you that thought, okay, this is probably what they do with Egyptian Americans or people from the Middle East. They're going to double check their story. They're going to come to their office. And you know what? I'm an American now. Maybe that's not such a bad thing if they're being that diligent. Was there even a part of you that thought this is kind of what they have to do to assure themselves that flights will be safe?
Oh, I never blamed them, and I do not blame them. But Mr. Gordon, let me explain to you. If I'm in a plane for 3.5 hours and I am Mr. Mohammed Fikri, the guy who's going to down a nation, who's going to hurt 275 passengers, why in the world do you leave me for 3 hours playing this game and have a flight attendant sitting next to me who does not have a gun to tame me? Why couldn't you not fly the aeroplane? If this lady came out, this is the only thing that I have that's really killing me. The plane was in the ground. Why did you fly the aeroplane with this suspicious criminal on the plane?
Right. If they really had a question, they should have asked it in Chicago, not in L.A.
Do me as a person, do I really, honestly, truly in my heart blame them? Absolutely not. You know why, Mr. Gordon? Because every time I take a trip, I wanted to go back home to my loved one. I'm only 54 years old. I do not want to die yet.
Did you check with Homeland Security or the FBI or any of the authorities after that? Did you say, do me a favor, look up the name Mohammed Fikri. Tell me that there's no little flag on it that says, watch this guy. Because you'd already been put through the ringer once. The guy had said you're clear. Did you check to make sure that, in fact, your name was clear as far as the official records go?
No, I never bothered because I knew I wouldn't get an answer.
So Mo Fikri kept on flying. He was getting closer to that 5-million-mile mark. And at that level, you get to know the airline people and they get to know you. Mo says he was on a first-name basis with many of the American Airlines staff. This past summer, Mo was headed to the airport again, booked on a flight that he took regularly from L.A. to London.
I went to LAX about 3 hours before the flight because I like to be at the airport real early. And I don't travel with wearing a suit and a tie. I take my sweatpants and a beautifully ugly white T-shirt that I travel in. I like to travel comfortably. And here we go. I get in the flight. I sat in seat number 13J, and that's the very last seat entering the plane in your left-hand side next to the window.
It's business class, right?
Yes, sir. I went to the bathroom. I changed my jeans and my shirt into my sweatpants and my T-shirt and put my little duffel bag up, which is the only thing I travel with. And it had my Bristol Farm ham and cheese sandwich, really great ham and cheese, rosemary ham. I start putting my stuff down, and this flight attendant, she was like, got to be about 60 years old, very pretty, very blonde. And she came and she said, can I get you anything? I said, no, thank you. Do you want the menu for dinner? I said, no, thanks. I can't handle gourmet. That's a thing I came up with to tell them that I don't like their food. She said, am I going to eat anything? I said, yeah, just a glass of wine. That's going to be about it.
But that was just the beginning of Mo Fikri's moment as a national security matter. He settled into seat 13J with no idea of what lay ahead, and we'll talk about what happened next in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And we all have our travel nightmare stories. Thousands of people who had hoped to fly American Airlines last month found out what can happen when the better part of a fleet is grounded for safety inspections. But even the worst of those travel stories isn't likely to put you on the evening news. Mohammed Fikri was not so lucky. You see, Mo flies a lot. This past summer, he was on a flight from L.A. to London. He chatted with one of the women flight attendants, settled into his seat, and then another woman sat in the seat beside him.
And we greet each other. Hi, how are you? Where are you going? Oh, I'm going to go see my daughter. She's in, I don't remember, Spain or whatever. They're going to tour together. That's wonderful. And I was taking the flight to London, and from London I go to Amsterdam. And that flight attendant, when I was putting my duffel bag up after I took my sandwiches and my newspaper and my eyeglasses and all that stuff, she said, oh, you look familiar. I think I saw you in the tram. I have to admit that I told her yes. I said, oh, I'm sure. I didn't say yes. Let me correct that. Yeah. I said, oh, I'm sure you have.
So when she says, did I see you on the tram, you're thinking, oh, maybe it's some kind of airport shuttle or some train.
There's no maybe. That's exactly, my brain went automatically to Dallas, and American Airlines have a great base in Dallas. I said, oh, I'm sure you have. And she came. That lady next to me went to the bathroom to do whatever she does, and she came and sat next to me.
The flight attendant did.
Yes, and they usually don't do that.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, And I really, inside of me, I was going to tell her that, like, well, darling, I'm involved in a relationship for 8 years, but, and she said, can I have one of your business cards? I said, sure. Here. Gave her the business card. And that was the end of it. I took my sleeping pill, talked for a second, that lady next to me, had my beautiful ham and cheese sandwich, and I had my cookies, and I had my banana, and I had a glass of wine or maybe two. And after that, I crashed. And I hear some raucous, like something in the intercom, and it was the captain saying that, ladies and gentlemen, we started our descent. We're going to be landing shortly. And I just looked off. I didn't even look at my watch. I looked out of the window, and it was dark. It didn't look anything like London. It looked like the U.S. And I looked at my watch, and it was about 4 hours and 45 minutes. And I don't care if you're even flying those people with a Concorde. You would not make it in 4 hours and 45 minutes. And, of course, I asked the lady next to me, I said, what's going on? She said, we ran out of fuel.
So where are you landing?
We landed in JFK.
Okay.
And my brain went right away like, okay, Mr. Gordon have a problem in the air. He's not going to tell all the employees that there's something on fire, God forbid, in the area where he's at. He's going to say, we got to get off the air now. We got to resume in 10 minutes because you're the captain of the ship, I assume. And I figured that, hey, the guy have a problem, mechanical problem. He's not going to admit that to everybody and scare the living life out of them. And when we were landing, I looked for any fire brigade. I looked for any foam. There was none. And the captain went in the intercom and said, ladies and gentlemen, please refrain from using the facilities. Please refrain from moving out of your seat. We have a national security matter. And I figured, oh, man, that's great. At least we landed safe. Fair enough, when they opened the door, you've been to a 777 before, have you?
Yeah, it's a big aircraft.
Yeah, and just imagine you're coming from the gate and you're sitting in 13J. I mean, you have the whole thing. I mean, you're a front seat at a concert. And I see all this. Oh, my God, I cannot remember. Maybe 10, 12, 15. Not 5, not 3, not 4. They're all swarming toward my seat. And the finger was pointed at me.
These are guys in uniform? What are you seeing?
Everything. There was about 7 or 8 NYPD and about 4 undercover, you know, wearing a shirt and the pants like you and me. And, of course, all the FBI, CIA, and all that crap start flashing. And they said, you got your belongings off the plane. We're taking your bag off the plane now. And that was just a comment. And everybody asked me, well, what did you say? Well, what the heck are you going to say when you got 15 guys with guns and badges? You're going to tell them, no, I'm not. Of course I did. I asked one guy, he was bald-headed, NYPD-dressed guy. I said, can I just at least change my clothes now? And I said, like, wow. And he looked very scary. He looked like he'd eat children for breakfast. And they took me to the jetway. It's just me and the jetway. We have a love story, I think.
This is, of course, after everybody on the plane sees you plucked out of your seat and frog marched out the door once again.
Oh, right? It's beautiful. It was the Ayatollah Khomeini's son being taken off the plane, pal. And they just sat there. They said, do you know why we stopped the airplane and why we're taking you off the plane? I said, you asking me? He said, yeah. I said, I really have no idea. He was like, not a clue. I said, no. All right. Came another guy. Mr. Figgery, do you know why we stopped the plane? I said, guys, do me a favor. I have no idea. Please enlighten me because I have no clue. I was going to London. Now I'm a JFK. Well, Mr. Figgery, the flight attendant saw you on the tram. I said, saw me in the tram? She asked me if I ever been in a might saw you in the tram. I said, yeah, there's a good possibility you saw me in the tram. Yeah, they have trams in Dallas. We don't have trams in L.A. And one of them said, you were on the tram in L.A. Well, for God's sake, we don't have a tram in L.A.
Mo Fikri would soon find out the source of the confusion. You see, there is a tram in L.A., but the only people who use it are American Airlines employees. And so it seemed to the flight attendant that Mo might have been posing as an airline employee to avoid security. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Mo doesn't know this yet, but he's not just standing on the jetway with the police. He's also on the news.
Last night, New York time, 9 p.m., flight 136 took off from LAX en route to London and was diverted around 4 a.m. because a heads-up flight crew determined that one of the passengers, a male, was suspicious. Sometimes there's an anonymous air marshal on board, but this time it was the flight crew. Security boarded the plane, took the person off the plane, and now that individual is in custody.
I said, I want to go to the bathroom. And the guy said, no, you can't. I said, hell, I can't. I said, after all this? I said, no, I'm going to go to the bathroom. And I stood up. I said, by the way, I really don't care what you guys are going to do. I'm going to go to the bathroom. And by the way, where I came from, we don't shoot people from the back. We shoot them from the front. And one of the big police guys said, well, we're going to send two guys with you. And two policemen came with me to the bathroom, one at the door and one inside. And I was looking at him like, this is the most uncomfortable position on earth. Went inside, hurry up. Hey, gotta wash my hand. Didn't your mama teach you to wash your hand after you go to the bathroom? And I figured, you know what? I'm just going to start really humoring those guys because that's the only way it's going to survive.
But wait a second. Let me just interrupt you for a minute here. I mean,
sure, please do.
Was there even a little part of you, Mo, that thought to yourself, I'm in serious trouble here? I mean, I could wind up in Guantanamo Bay if I'm not polite.
Not at all.
You never thought that?
Not at all. Not at all. No, okay. That did not cross my mind. But was I scared? Oh, man, I was poo-poo in my pants. But you never show them that you are sweating. Never, ever show anybody that you sweat. I went back and they said, well, I'm waiting for the FBI. And I'm like, okay. I said, hey, guys, can I just go to sleep, please? And I did fall asleep right there by the counter. I slept on my duffel bag for about 2 hours. And when I woke up, there was a big ruckus, people moving and people going. They were taking everybody off the plane. And I had to shut my eyes very quick again because everybody, I think if people had the chance to really honestly spit on me or just stomp me, I think they would have done so. Because what I felt is I felt that they have seen a criminal first time in their life, somebody that couldn't down an airplane. Some of them are thinking that.
Well, they probably have no reason to believe that you're not a terrorist, right? They've seen you hauled off the plane, and then they sit on the plane, and then 2 hours later, they're hauled off the plane. Their trip's all messed up.
You messed up their plan. This lady next to me was going to meet with her daughter in Spain or whatever the hell, and they have planned to do it. They took everybody to a hotel. And of course, they left me right in there till I got two FBI guys and a tall guy from that TSA. That was about 3 hours later after I woke up and all this crap. And he asked me, what's in my bag? I said, I have a ham and cheese sandwich and I have a bottle of whiskey. And he was kind of surprised because ham and cheese sandwich for a Muslim guy by the name of Muhammad, they don't eat no ham. They don't like no pigs. I do.
When did you know things were going to be okay, though?
From the minute they took me off the plane, I knew that there was some mistake. I'm not sounding cocky, but this is the way it is. When you don't do anything wrong, what the heck do you have to worry about it?
When did they let you go, though, Mo?
Oh, boy, when did they ever let me go? It was about 8 hours episode, 9 hours.
You were being questioned or you were just basically being left alone most of the time?
No, they've been grinding me between the NYPD and between the TSA and between the FBI, all kind of questions. And I told them where I parked and my license plate, because I don't have a regular license plate. My license plate is FLNGGD, which it means feeling good. Okay. Not at that moment when I gave them
that.
That's
so good. No.
I was going to change it. I was not allowed to use my cell phone. They let me eat my ham and cheese sandwich. It was good. They were examining my passport. In 7 years, my passport looked, with all due respect, like the miniature Muslim Quran or the Mormon book, with stamps all over the place. And of course they have to question you, why do you go to Thailand, why do you go to Egypt, and what's in Egypt? And I was asked if I would like to pray. I said, pray? If you show me how, I would. And I think my determination and me asking the question professionally and not getting angry, because you could get angry, but why? It's not going to get you anywhere.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As it turned out, the flight attendant who had raised the alarm in the first place told everyone that she really had no firm recollection of ever seeing Muhammad on the airline tram. And Muhammad Fikri says what bothered him more than anything else was that no one would allow him to explain the confusion, to tell his story. So he ended up in the security office for American Airlines. He waited hours. He found out later that the FBI had been checking out everything to see that his car was where he'd left it. They'd called his girlfriend in his office. Eventually, word came back from the federal agents.
The FBI came and they said, Mr. Fikri, we please accept our sincerest apology. Now we'll leave you with the airlines. They're going to sort it out. They give me a choice. Would I like to go home or would I like to continue? It's like, hello, I'm not going because my daddy is rich. I'm going to make a living. They put me in a flight with Delta Airlines, direct flight from JFK to Amsterdam that did not leave till early part of the evening, about 5 p.m. I went to the American Airlines in JFK where they have a bathroom and a shower and whatever. They give me towel and all that stuff. And Mr. Gordon, it was so beautiful sitting right there drinking a cup of coffee and just counting your blessing that you're getting the next flight. And fair enough, CNN.
Mo Fikri says he suddenly realized that the people in the airport lounge with him were watching the news about his supposed threat to their safety. And he heard them cursing the terrorists.
And everybody going like, I heard, those God mothers, it would never end. He should just kill all. As you can say, like, hey guys, that stuff with a hoax, that was crap. That was me. But of course, you don't want to say anything. And anyway, I just went back and did my trip. And coming back in American Airlines, you know how they put your boarding pass into that little machine that came back? And I'm going like, here we go again. That was on Sunday, by the way, coming back from Heathrow. And the lady said, oh, Mr. Fikri, they have upgraded you to first class. I said, I don't want to go first class. I just want to get my seat. And one of the flight attendants knew me. And they said, oh, I feel so horrible. What can we get you? You don't give me anything. Just give me an extra pack of peanuts.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Mohammed Fikri says he never did get a letter or an apology from the airline, and he says he's not expecting one.
Mr. Gordon, when you send me a letter today to tell me I am sorry that I called you Mohammed the Muslim, it means you are admitting guilt, okay? American Airlines just sent a blast email to every John, Dick, and Harry fly with them 2 weeks ago to tell them, please accept our sincerest apology for the inconvenience that we have caused you by cancellation of some of the flight and delay of some of the flight. But because you are Mohammed friggin' Fikri, you would not get a letter from them to say, I am sorry. All what I was looking for was, I am sorry. That's all what I was looking for. Never get it. Never by phone. Never by a gesture. Never by anything. And they claim at the end, oh, but we flew you business class from JFK to Holland. Big friggin' deal. No, I didn't get a letter of an apology. And to top this, now, why am I getting so angry? Sorry.
Mohammed Fikri says he continued to fly with American Airlines. Something about that quest to reach the 5 million mile mark. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Earlier this year, Mo Fikri got on a flight out of Tokyo, and he found himself facing the flight attendant from 6 months earlier.
The same flight attendant, her name.
The same flight attendant who saw to it that you were pulled off the flight in New York, right?
Yes. The look was just like, whoa. And after that, the galley, which is where they serve the food and whatever have you, is between first and business. And every single flight attendant in that flight was like coming in, open that little curtain, go behind it, and looking at that little creature that...
peeking at you.
Yes. Huh. And I felt horrible.
So now you feel like a bug in a jar, right?
That's not the wrong English. You see, bug in a jar. I like that. Yeah. And I have asked one of the flight attendants that I know very well. Her name is Debbie. I said, Debbie, is there any way? And she knew. I said, Debbie, is there any way that you can ask the purser to move her into business class or somewhere else or whatever? My request was denied. Whoever put her in the flight, there's something called a manifest.
Yeah.
You know that stupid Mohammed Fikri is back on the flight. Do you have to put the flight attendant with him in the same cabin?
So what did you do?
I moved back to coach. And that's when I've decided that, you know what? There is no more American Airlines. There is no more achieving that goal of getting 5 million miles. Why did I want 5? I don't know. Just something that...
You did make it to 5 million miles, though, didn't you?
No, sir. 4,997,000 and some miles.
With American Airlines?
Yes.
And now you don't fly them anymore?
Absolutely not. I have not stepped a foot after that instant. It's all, I'm going to say paranoid nation. I don't blame the FBI and the CIA because their job is to protect the nation.
Mo Fikri says he's now changing his job so he doesn't have to fly so much anymore. He's just thinking it'll be easier on him not to have to argue for his innocence again.
A lot of people that came here to the U.S. from different countries, you know, from Mexico, Latin America, Romania, wherever, they all came in here to do something good for themselves. They came here to serve the USA and to be a part of it, to be a part of the culture. And it's unfortunate. It's really, really unfortunate thing. And does this country still see colors? Yes, of course. Is that going to ever change? Heck no. It's pretty sad.
Mohammed Fikri joined me from the studios of KUSC in LA. If you have a story of your own to relate, or some thought, reaction to Mo's story, let me know. You can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Who here hasn't at one time or another watched Home Shopping on TV? Who among us hasn't been caught up in the way that things are sold, like the Kirk's Folly Fly Home Angel Wing keychain available now from QVC, the home TV shopping network, for the special introductory price of $18.43.
Inexpensive little crummy purse that you bought somewhere and put this hanging off of it, and
it looks
fabulous.
It does. I mean, this is just something that I think everyone can relate to and everyone can enjoy. Listen, it's a message.
It sends something from the heart
that you care.
That's right.
And I think in this time, in this day and age,
we need a little bit of that. Yep,
definitely.
We really do.
Definitely.
And
yeah.
Meg Favreau was finishing up her writing degree at college. She needed a job, and she was hoping for a job in publishing.
I had two options when I graduated. I could move in with my boyfriend in the Philadelphia area, or I could go back to northern New Hampshire with my parents and live in the same 300-person town I grew up in. So I thought that the Philadelphia option was a lot better. But it's not a great market for writing jobs.
Right.
So I looked and looked and looked, and I found a few things. And I only got two interviews, and one of them was QVC. And I still remain convinced that a large part of the reason why I got the job is because it started as a part-time position, and a lot of people didn't want that.
Tell me, was it that this home television channel wanted you, the aspiring writer, or that you, the aspiring writer, wanted to work on a television shopping channel?
It was that they wanted me primarily.
This is pretty flattering when you're just coming out of college.
Yeah.
Sure
no, it certainly is. I was sort of grossed out, I guess, by the idea of working in a marketing position. I was still, I still consider myself an idealistic person, but I think there's a sort of college idealism where you think that you can do everything you want and make a living without ever doing anything you think you don't want to do, if that makes sense.
I'd call that idealism.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that you learn a lot once you have to support yourself,
so,
shall we say.
Did you tell friends and family about this job that you were going to?
I did. And I was a little not embarrassed to tell them, but I always sort of was like, yeah, I don't know how that's going to be, because I had the very stereotypical vision of QVC that a lot of people have, which is it markets bad or useless products, you know, to people who don't need them. Hummel figurines.
Yeah, the kind of cheesy stuff that won't move on the shelf in the store, so put it on TV and someone will
buy. Yeah.
But what did people say to you about this job you were going off to?
Well, my parents were, first of all, absolutely thrilled that I had a job. People were very positive, which I was, I guess, not surprised about. I was a little surprised about. They all thought it was a hoot, pretty much. But the reaction I got from almost every single person I told was they would stick out their hand and say, oh, are you going to be a hand model? I write on my hand a lot. So they're not great for selling the Diamond E.
Okay. Meg Favreau's first day on the job wasn't quite what she expected. Someone tried to explain to her the company philosophy, what they called the QVC difference.
It's things like fun along the way, where, you know, we all have fun in our jobs.
Sounds like working
like
at the Story.
but selling fewer products, I imagine.
I got you. Okay.
At the Story.
So what were you doing when you started, though?
Basically data entry, taking information from a product description, and these panels showed up on the side of the screen. So like if you're looking at a pair of yoke front pants, for example.
Okay.
And you want to know what size the waist on the extra small is. Like, that information would come up on the side of the screen while these pants were being sold. And I was also writing little cue cards for the host to read for hot picks, which were items that had sold really well in the past, and QVC wanted to put them out there more.
So you were actually writing some of the copy that we hear on TV.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And
give me an example of the sort of stuff that you would write, or the product pitches, that sort of thing.
Okay, so this is for a show called 14 Karat Gold Designs by Maury Piopo. Are you ready to be inspired? Designer Maury Piopo has built her career creating sensual, organic jewelry, influenced by the spirituality of yoga and a love of texture. Elegant and edgy. Celebrated by the World Gold Council and worn by A-list celebrities. Let yourself be captivated with 14 Karat Gold Designs by Maury Piopo, premiering Monday at 1 a.m. Eastern on QVC. So that was the sort of thing.
I'm captivated. That's great. I can see you having fun with this, Meg.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of fun a lot of the time, which I was surprised about.
You know I'm going to ask you next about what wasn't fun some of the time.
Well, I mean, the fact that so much of my job was data entry
right. Certainly
wasn't fun. For QVC's 20th anniversary, they brought us all into the central area of the building, and they had this insane announcement ceremony where, like, they had one of the hosts jumping through one of those paper circles that you mm-hmm. would see at, like, a football game.
Yeah.
They had the breakaway glass bottles, and they were throwing them up in the air and smashing them with baseball bats. I mean, just ridiculous stuff, all to announce this contest where we all got T-shirts that said QVC on them, and the contest was to get into the media wearing these T-shirts.
You're supposed to stand behind the glass at like the Today Show wearing your
right,
QVC
shirt. Right, right. Exactly. It really bothered me because people were getting very excited about it because they had a chance to win money. But I felt like it was dishonest because it was taking the employees and using them to do free advertising.
But Meg, I have to ask you. Isn't the whole thing about television home shopping a little bit dishonest? I mean, it's about trying to persuade somebody that there's great value in something that doesn't really have a lot of value.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And to be fair, one of the things I did discover at QVC was that a lot of the products were better than I expected them to be. But at the same time, there were things that I didn't feel comfortable with, like Easy Pay.
Three easy payments, that sort of thing?
Right, exactly. They'll put easy pay on inexpensive items sometimes. And it's like, all I could think when I saw something on $20 easy pay was, if you can't afford $20 right now, you should not be buying this.
Meg Favreau didn't spend all her time on the computer, though. She says early on, she got close to the actual set, the place where the TV magic happens.
My second day at work, I was on air ladling chili. Despite my not very nice hands, I was a sort of hand model.
I have to ask you, Meg, did you then go home at night and watch and say, those are my hands, that's me with the chili?
Yeah, I did. I actually didn't even have to go home to do it. I just turned it on at my desk.
There and, I am. Is it what we think it is? I mean, the camera works so close on hand models and, you know, food processors and what, I don't know. I mean, you know more about what's moved mm-hmm. there than I do. But what did you see there that I don't see if I watch it at home?
Well, the same shoot where I was ladling the chili, there was also, it was for Dutch ovens. So we were showing, you know, all the different foods you can cook in these Dutch ovens. And one of them was this lobster that had been in the walk-in fridge for I don't know how many days. and it looked really sad. So I had this coworker who just was very, very sassy, straightforward lady, and she's just standing there. She whips out this can of Pam spray oil, shakes it up, and just coats the whole thing. So there's this thick layer of oil. And it looked amazing. I mean, it looked great after that. It was like, oh, wow, I'll eat that now. Wait, no, I just saw that look disgusting. Can't do that.
So the little shine of the Pam makes even a gnarly lobster look good on
yeah.
television.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, if there was part of that glamour aspect of the job that kept you there, the fact that, you know, celebrities would come through and the faces that you'd see on television you'd pass in the hallway, or did you get tired of that kind of quickly? What was your feeling?
I certainly didn't get tired of it. One of my great sadnesses about leaving what I did is that I never got FaceTime with Joan Rivers. And it got to the ridiculous point where one day they were actually shooting a Joan Rivers promo in the area where I worked, but I was really, really hungry and I just had to take lunch. And when I came back from lunch, they were done shooting the promo.
You missed her.
Yeah, yeah. But after I left QVC, the woman who I knew there commissioned me to make a Joan Rivers puppet.
Tell me something. If you're there and you're, you know, kind of hanging out with the people who work there, do you ever in any way get drawn in yourself and start paying attention to what the special of the moment is?
Oh, definitely. For me, I think part of that draw was the employee discount. But yeah, I bought a lot of stuff when I was there that I would never have bought normally. Oh, gosh. I bought so much stuff.
Open those closets. Let's see what's tucked away there.
Okay. So the first stuff I bought was makeup, which I wear a little bit of makeup, not a lot. I had an eye rash, and so I bought this eye cream to try to counteract the eye rash, which didn't work, but I still really liked the cream. So then I bought eyeshadow from the same people, and then I bought eyeliner, and then a couple of pillows. Oh, around Christmas one year, I bought this UFO toy, which was remote controlled, and it shoots 40 feet up into the air.
You really needed this.
Well, because it was the sort of thing that I had always wanted as a child,
yeah,
and my mom never bought me remote controlled stuff. So it's, you know, I mean, it was a totally stupid purchase.
But what was your discount, though, Meg? I mean, how hard was it to resist this stuff?
It was 30%. It wasn't a huge discount, but it just made it easier to treat myself. Like, it wasn't hard to resist, but it's like, now I have the discount. And then around Christmas, it was especially bad because it was like, oh, now I'm going to treat my whole family. Even when I was writing the copy that was helping to sell the stuff, I didn't like watching the channel because I don't like being sold at.
Right.
And they don't have your best interest in mind as the shopper. They have their best interest in mind, which I don't mean that to sound
no, no, but the
so
funny thing
awful,
is that you and I will talk about it here, Meg, being sort of high-minded and who would ever buy
yeah.
that stuff. And you know what? We all end up buying it, right?
Right, right. But it was funny because it was when I was reading the product descriptions or if I actually like saw a product face-to-face, like that's when I started buying.
One weekend, Meg Favreau volunteered to work behind the jewelry counter at a QVC outlet store. People drifted by, looking for deals, but one particular guy caught Meg's attention.
He was there with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's mom, I believe, and they were across the store. And so he was looking at the Diamondique engagement rings and says to me, he's like, how much are these? I said that they were between $10 and $15, depending on which one. And he was like, oh, my God, because he thought they were real diamonds.
These are genuine imitation diamonds.
I think the catchphrase is the world's finest simulated diamonds.
I love that.
For Dominique.
So what are you thinking? Are you thinking that you should, like, tell him to back off, or are you trying to – what are you doing?
Well, I tend to take kind of a hands-off approach in those situations because I'm sort of the mindset where it's like, wow, I would really not do this. But in my place as an employee right now, mm-hmm. I really don't think that I should say anything telling him not to buy. And so I kind of was smiling and nodding. And, you know, he looks across the store to his girlfriend and he's like, these look really real. I'm going to come back and get one of these. And I was just like, oh goodness, like this guy is going to buy a Dominique engagement ring for his wife. And so he said he was going to come back later. So I was so happy that I did not have to be in the position of selling him that ring. Because I think it's such a terrible idea to start a marriage with a lie that you got somebody a real diamond when it's not real.
On the other hand, he might have said, this is a Dominique ring from QVC.
Yeah, fair enough.
Not likely, though, right?
Yeah. By the way, he was staring across the store to make sure his girlfriend wasn't looking at him, looking at the rings. I'm guessing that wasn't what he was going for.
Why did you decide to leave the company, Meg?
It was a couple of different reasons. The job lost a lot of its luster towards the end. I wasn't really doing the fun stuff anymore. I was doing the data entry or supervising other people. And it was just, it was boring. And I really didn't want to sit around in a job I wasn't happy with, feeling like I was waiting for someone to die. Move on is the more positive way to say that, I guess.
Well, that's kind of the interesting part of it. I mean, every time you get to look at the inside workings of something like, you know, home shopping channels, then they become different. Then you sort of know something that other people don't. When you think back to the time that you spent there, I mean, did the job change you in any way?
Yeah, I think it certainly made me more aware of gray areas in a lot of ways because, you know, I went in very disparaging of TV shopping and I came out realizing that there are okay parts to it and that, you know, this company that I thought sold nothing good whatsoever actually did sell some nice products. I think I also realized in my time there that making a living isn't always what you think it's going to be, but that's okay.
When was the last time you bought something from them?
I had one of my friends buy me a pair of winter boots this winter.
You didn't want your name popping up in their website?
Well, no, because my friend still works there, so it was the employee discount.
We won't tell anybody about that, though.
Shh.
Meg, thanks so much for being with me. It was great having you on the program.
Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
Meg Fabro now works as a freelance writer in Philadelphia. If you go to our website, you can read more about Meg's job behind the scenes at a home shopping channel and also find a link to her blog. You'll get all that on our website at thestory.org. And if you have your own story about that first job out of college, which wasn't really quite what you expected it would be, or perhaps the way that you're shopping now, as we are all, as consumers, guarding dollars and cents a little bit more carefully, you've got a story about that, get in touch with me. The website is thestory.org. Or you can leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.